Welcome to the Shortwave Report for June 29th, 2012. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on a shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast or a computer with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's www.outfarpress.com, you can find a schedule for dozens of international broadcasters in English. There you can also listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Radio Deutsche Welle, Spanish National Radio, Radio Havana Cuba, The Voice of Russia, and NHK Japan. We'll begin with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. Queen Elizabeth II shook hands with Martin McGuinness, Sinn Féin politician and former IRA commander. A court in Germany has ruled that circumcising boys on religious grounds is illegal. An in-depth report on the chances of the new Greek government being successful at remaining in the European Union. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
Queen Elizabeth II shook hands with former IRA commander Martin McGuinness on Wednesday. The gesture is seen as a highly symbolic moment in the Northern Ireland peace process. The initial handshake between the Queen and McGuinness took place behind closed doors in a Belfast theatre. The two then shook hands a second time for the cameras as the Queen left the building. McGuinness is a member of Sinn Féin, the Irish Republican Army's political wing. He's now Deputy First Minister of Northern Ireland. The IRA decided to renounce violence in 2005.
A court in Germany has ruled that the circumcision of young boys on religious grounds is illegal. A regional court in the western city of Cologne said it amounted to grievous bodily harm, even if parents had agreed to the procedure. It said the child's rights to physical integrity outweighed freedom of religion and parents' rights. The landmark ruling is expected to set a legal precedent when German courts rule on similar cases. It's outraged Jewish and Muslim communities, among whom the circumcision of young boys has long been common practice. The president of Germany's Central Council of Jews described the move as unexpected and insensitive.
Greece breathed a sigh of relief this week when its month-long political crisis came to an end. Three parties agreed to form a coalition government, the conservative New Democracy and socialist PASOK and Democratic Left. The new government is committed to Greece staying in the eurozone and willing to follow through on reforms. But even though this has eased immediate worries, the outlook for the new government remains gloomy. In the end, the coalition is essentially the same as the government that led Greece into the crisis in the first place. I had a chance to talk to our Greece correspondent, Kitty Logan, about the chances of this new government.
Well, that's a good question because many Greeks are actually quite cynical about the makeup of this new three-party coalition government. It includes many political figures from Greece's past, and of course, people here are very suspicious of that. But having said that, of course, Europe's leaders and global financial markets are very relieved that Greece now does have a government. But there is, as we speak, still haggling over the cabinet members and, of course, policy, because not all of the parties on board in this new government are actually in agreement with the EU bailout plan.
Despite the weekend election that mollified fears that Greece would exit the eurozone, the outlook still isn't very good. Would you say that Greece is a failed state?
Well, I've been out seeing people on the streets of Athens over the past couple of days. I've been visiting soup kitchens, charity handouts, places where people get free medical care. And certainly there is an air of quiet despair amongst the Greeks. Many here have lost their jobs. 1 in 4 people is unemployed here. And those people have no medical insurance anymore. Some of them don't have any means to feed themselves. And they are now dependent on these charity handouts. So certainly people here are quite fed up with the political scene. But I think the question is now, what will happen? Will Greece stick to the bailout plan? Will it be able to implement the necessary austerity cuts without its people becoming extremely dissatisfied with the level of livelihood that they have in this country?
How is Greece dealing with this kind of catch-22? The government will have to appease Brussels without igniting the wrath of the people.
it's going to be very difficult for this new government. They have committed to the EU bailout plan, but already there are noises amongst the coalition, this new coalition, that they might not be able to do that, that they might want to renegotiate some parts of that. And of course, the EU, particularly Germany, has said that there is no concessions. There can be no further concessions towards Greece. They must stick to those cuts. But of course, any further cuts would mean a decrease in the quality of life for people here. And already people are very restless. And don't forget, there's also a very strong opposition party. The opposition Syriza party did very well in this election. They have a lot of supporters and they have a reputation for organizing very strong, very vocal protests. So they could certainly be a thorn in the side to this new government.
The election showed just how divided the Greek people are. Will the fact that almost half of Greeks did not vote for this government result in further protests?
Well, it's quite interesting. If you look at the votes that these three parties which form the new government actually got, it adds up to 48% of the vote. Now, that's not an awful lot if you think about it, that three parties could only put 48% of the people together amongst them. So that leaves the other half of the population, which presumably did not support this new government, is suspicious of it, doesn't trust it. Many Greeks I've spoken to don't believe that any real changes are going to come for them out of this new government. So certainly, I think it's a very real possibility that if things don't go well, and if further cuts are imposed on people, that there could be, again, protests in the capital, Athens.
Do you think the fascist party, the Golden Dawn, poses a threat to stability in Greece, even after their weaker showing at the second round of elections?
Well, it's certainly remarkable that they have done as well as they did so far. And I think it reflects frustration in Greek society at this point in time. But I think we're going to have to wait and see what comes out of that. I mean, certainly it is alarming. Many people here believe that they do have seats in Parliament. But at this moment, they're not a political force to be reckoned with. But certainly just operating on the edge of Greek politics, they are able to cause perhaps a lot of disruption and fear in society, particularly amongst the immigrants here.
And Kitty, just before we go, you are in Athens right now. Can you give us a sense of what it's like to be on the streets there?
It's quite strange in the center of Athens because in some ways it feels like a normal city. People are going about their daily business. There's life. People, some of them are going to work at least. But then you look in the doorways and look in the side streets and you see the families that are homeless, a couple with a small child in a doorway, or perhaps a woman who looks normal, but then you look at her shoes and she's barefooted and you can tell that she's homeless. So I think it's a very strange mix now of a city and a country trying to be normal, trying to be part of Europe and trying to recover, and people here who really lost everything and have no hope that they will regain their livelihoods, and increasing numbers of people now joining the homeless and joining those who are desperate and have simply no means to survive because of the cuts that this society has imposed on them.
Our correspondent Kitty Logan there speaking from Athens.
Those reports were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, mediacenter.dw-world.de. All the times I'm announcing are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so adjust them to your time zone. Next, Spanish National Radio. European leaders were strongly divided as they went into this week's economic summit. The finance ministers of the Eurozone agreed that Spanish banks qualify for a rescue bailout, but that the state must guarantee the loan. The president of Paraguay was ousted in a parliamentary coup, and their Supreme Court denied his appeal. Spanish National Radio.
On the eve of the European summit to be held in Brussels over the next 2 days, Europe's leaders seem divided as never before about the best way out of the financial crisis which is threatening the existence of the euro. The common stance on European issues in recent years between Germany and France, the big two economies, no longer exists since Nicolas Sarkozy lost the presidency to the socialist François Hollande. The new French president believes there should be more solidarity in Europe before member states cede sovereignty over their budgets, whereas Chancellor Angela Merkel says Germany won't agree to share Europe's debt until there's greater control over public spending.
Earlier today, Mrs. Merkel again rejected the idea of pooling Eurozone debt through bonds and urged greater competitiveness in the European Union. To loud applause in Parliament in Berlin, she said that the proposal for Eurobonds went against Germany's constitution. Mrs. Merkel is meeting President Hollande for dinner in Paris tonight to see if they can iron out their differences before the summit starts tomorrow.
The finance ministers of the Eurozone, the so-called Eurogroup, have confirmed that Spain does meet the conditions required to get a rescue fund for its troubled banks. But the bad news for Madrid is that they also say that it will be the Spanish state who will be responsible for guaranteeing the loan.
Europe announced last week that Spain could have up to as much as 100 billion euros to restructure its banks. The nitty-gritty of the size of the deal and its costs have still to be worked out, following the reports of two independent auditors which concluded that Spanish banks would need between 51 and 62 billion euros. That's well within the figure offered by Europe, but a safety margin will also be needed to shore up against any further deterioration of the banking system.
It's also been confirmed that technocrats from the European Commission have arrived in Madrid to start their own analysis of the Spanish banking sector. Their reports will serve as the basis for the negotiations of the terms of the loans to Spanish banks.
Paraguay's Supreme Court has dismissed the appeal by ousted President Fernando Lugo against what he termed the parliamentary coup that deposed him. On Friday, the Paraguayan Senate voted 39-4 to dismiss Mr. Lugo over his handling of a recent land dispute that resulted in at least 17 deaths. A former priest known for defending peasant rights, Mr. Lugo's 2008 election ended more than 60 years of rule by the right-wing Colorado Party. Latin American countries, including Argentina, Brazil, Venezuela, Chile, and Uruguay, have also condemned Mr. Lugo's ouster and have recalled their ambassadors.
Those reports were from Spanish National Radio, heard from 5 to 6 p.m. at 6055 and podcasting at rtve.es. Also, World Radio Network is now podcasting their shows, which is great, at wrn.org. Next, Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuban President Raúl Castro rejected the coup in Paraguay and went on to criticize the U.S. involvement in numerous coups and attempted coups in Latin America. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Cuban President Raúl Castro reiterated Cuba's rejection of the parliamentary coup perpetrated against Paraguay's constitutional president, Fernando Lugo. Speaking to reporters at the José Martí International Airport, shortly after seeing off his Belarusian counterpart, Alexander Lukashenko, Raúl Castro said he was not surprised and recalled the role played by the United States in the 1973 military coup against Chilean President Salvador Allende and the attempts to overthrow Venezuela's Hugo Chávez in 2002. The Cuban head of state recalled a conversation he had with revolution leader Fidel Castro several years ago. He said that at that time, Fidel assured him that if Washington deemed its interests were negatively affected, coup d'etats would return to the Americas. And they have returned, Raúl said, only that these coups now come in disguise.
Con Chávez, sí, se desesperaron y le intentaron un golpe militar.
They got desperate with Chávez and tried a military coup. But you know that story perfectly well. The people saved him. And then came the oil coup, which, economically speaking, caused great damages. With Evo, they tried a separatist variant by trying to divide the province of Media Luna into the forces of the local oligarchy and the ones of the extreme right. Then there was the case of Zelaya in Honduras, and now the situation with Lugo. That coup d'etat was not a coincidence. Nobody in this continent stages a coup by using the parliament without permission granted by the U.S.
Cuban President Raúl Castro stressing the importance of alternative media outlets like the international TV network Telesur, which reports about our nation's history and culture, as well as reliable information on our people's reality. He added that it is crucial to strengthen regional integration as a way to confront the imposed globalization under Washington's mandate.
That report was from Radio Havana, Cuba, heard from 1 to 2 p.m. at 11760 and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6060, 6050, or 6010, also streaming on the web from 6 p.m. to midnight at www.radiohc.cu and podcasting at World Radio Network, that is wrn.org. On to the Voice of Russia. Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter wrote an editorial in the New York Times severely criticizing the Obama administration for drone assassinations of people considered enemies of the United States, violating the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the voice of Russia.
Jimmy Carter, a prominent U.S. Democrat and Nobel Peace Prize winner, is speaking about the Obama administration's drone murders and its sending of death squads around the world to assassinate people the president considers to be enemies. The former U.S. president, in a New York Times op-ed piece published on the 24th of June, writes that the U.S. government now regularly violates the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Specifically, he wrote, Declaration has been invoked by human rights activists and the international community to replace most of the world's dictatorships with democracies and to promote the rule of law in domestic and global affairs. It is disturbing that, instead of strengthening these principles, the American government's counterterrorism policies are now clearly violating at least 10 of the Declaration's 30 articles, including the prohibition against cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment or punishment.
Unmanned aircraft became part of the U.S. arsenal in the 1990s, as reconnaissance drones recorded images of terrain in the Balkans. After the September 2001 terrorist attacks, President Bush signed a directive that authorized arming the drones, called Predators, with Hellfire missiles to try to take out terrorism suspects. He later widened the directive to allow strikes against anyone working inside terrorist camps, not just individual suspects.
According to military officials today, the United States is running two drone programs. The military is in charge of drones in Afghanistan, where the country is officially at war. The CIA, meanwhile, runs the drone program in Pakistan, an ally in the war in Afghanistan. The drone operations in Afghanistan are relatively straightforward, and U.S. officials routinely release information about the attacks. In Pakistan, where the CIA is running the show, the situation is different. As described by former U.S. officials who participated, it is conducted not by military generals, but by CIA officers who are guiding drones from offices in Langley, Virginia, that kill people in a country with which the U.S. is not at war.
According to the New America Foundation, a Washington-based public policy institute, President Barack Obama has authorized 193 drone strikes in Pakistan since he took office in 2009, more than four times the number of attacks that President George W. Bush authorized during his two terms. Addressing this issue, Washington Post columnist David Ignatius wrote in an op-ed piece that there's something about assassination from 10,000 feet that is more acceptable than it would be from 1 foot by the bayonet.
Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter has said that the drone strikes and targeted assassinations conducted by the Bush and the Obama administrations amounts to violations of human rights. He added that at a time when many countries around the world are experiencing popular revolutions, the U.S. should be strengthening, not weakening, basic rules of law and principles of justice. Carter continued by saying that America is abandoning its role as a champion of human rights and calls on Washington to reverse course and regain moral leadership.
The Nobel Peace Prize winner says attacks on human rights after the terrorist atrocities of 9/11 have been sanctioned and escalated by bipartisan executive and legislative actions without dissent from the general public. As a result, the United States can no longer speak with moral authority on these critical issues. He continued by saying, while America has made mistakes in the past, the widespread abuse of human rights over the last decade has been a dramatic change from the past.
Addressing drones, Carter writes, despite an arbitrary rule that any man killed by drones is declared an enemy terrorist, the death of nearby innocent women and children is accepted as inevitable. After more than 30 airstrikes on civilian homes this year in Afghanistan, President Hamid Karzai has demanded that such attacks end, but the practice continues in areas of Pakistan, Somalia, and Yemen that are not in any war zone. We don't know how many hundreds of innocent civilians have been killed in these attacks, each one approved by the highest authorities in Washington. This would have been unthinkable in previous times.
On June 21st, UN Rapporteur Christophe Haines told reporters at a UN Human Rights Council meeting that the U.S. needs to be held legally accountable for the use of armed drones. He requested that the Obama administration publish statistics on the number of civilian deaths caused by strikes on suspected terrorist leaders in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Yemen. He said, I don't think we have the full answer to the legal framework. We certainly don't have the answer to the accountability issues. He stressed that some of the attacks may constitute war crimes.
The American Civil Liberties Movement, or the ACLU, told the UN Human Rights Court on Wednesday that the United States has cobbled together its own legal framework for targeted killing, with standards that are far less stringent than the law allows. Figures published by the ACLU estimate that about 4,000 people have fallen victim to U.S. drone raids since 2002 in Yemen, Pakistan, and Somalia. The investigations show a large number of the casualties were civilian and that numbers have increased dramatically since Barack Obama assumed the presidency.
Jimmy Carter ended his piece in the New York Times by saying that, as concerned citizens, we must persuade Washington to reverse course and regain moral leadership according to international human rights norms that America has officially adopted as its own and cherished throughout the years.
That report was from the Voice of Russia. Russia is now heard from 6 p.m. to 11 at 15-425-9800 and 9665 or through their website www.english.ruvr.ru. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or would like to make a donation for production costs of this unfunded program, I may be reached through the website or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Please support independently produced radio. Donations are the only source of funding for this weekly program. We'll conclude with NHK World Radio Japan. The highest level of radiation to date has been detected at the Fukushima nuclear power plants. Shareholders in TEPCO, the owner-operators of the Fukushima nuclear power plants, voted to effectively nationalize the company because of debts from the accident last March. There was a large protest outside that shareholders' meeting. Last week, the government of Japan approved restarting two nuclear power plants. Local residents are seeking a court order to halt the startup. A Chinese bank has opened a branch in Taiwan. This will involve the direct trading of Chinese and Taiwanese currency without the U.S. dollar, something that is already happening between China and Japan. NHK.
The highest level of radiation to date has been detected inside the number one reactor vessel at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. Tokyo Electric Power Company said it used endoscopes and dosimeters to examine the interior of the reactor on Tuesday. Internal measurements were taken for the first time since the accident in March last year. The utility detected a record level of 10,300 millisieverts per hour. The measurement was taken 20 centimeters above the surface of a contaminated water puddle in the reactor's suppression chamber. This high level of radiation would be fatal for humans within 50 minutes. No broken parts were identified in the containment vessel during the survey. 1,000 millisieverts per hour was detected about 4 meters above the water surface. The figure is 10 times higher than those measured in the number 2 and number 3 reactors. Workers are expected to engage in cleanup and other tasks, mostly at the 4-meter level, which is raising health concerns. TEPCO official Junichi Matsumoto said he suspects that a higher radiation level in the number 1 reactor is caused by more fuel rods melting down than in other reactors. He said robots will be used for damage assessment because it is unsafe for humans to work on site.
The new president of Tokyo Electric Power Company has called for a review of its financial burden related to the nuclear accident in Fukushima. He's asked the government to bear part of the cost. In an interview with NHK, Naomi Hirose said it's impossible for the company to bear the burden alone. He said the costs stemming from compensation for people affected by the nuclear accident and decommissioning the plant will be huge. The utility is obliged to repay funds it borrowed from the government-backed Nuclear Damage Liability Facilitation Fund. TEPCO shareholders held an annual meeting on Wednesday. They voted in favor of a plan to effectively nationalize the troubled utility. The company will proceed with the special compensation and reconstruction program it worked out in May.
Environmentalists and citizens group protested at the site of the shareholder meeting of Tokyo Electric Power Company. The protesters from Japan and overseas gathered outside the TEPCO meeting at a gymnasium in central Tokyo on Wednesday. German conservationists passed out leaflets describing TEPCO as the world's most environmentally destructive company in 2011. They urged stockholders to conform to the public shift away from dependence on nuclear power. Young activists held up banners asking shareholders to abandon nuclear power generation. The activists linked up for the protest on the social network Twitter. One activist said the nuclear accident at Fukushima is still not over. She urged TEPCO shareholders to support the anti-nuclear proposal to stop forcing people in the regions to accept the burden of nuclear energy for the major cities.
Residents around a nuclear power plant on the Sea of Japan coast are seeking a court order to prevent the operator from restarting the number 1 and 2 reactors at the plant. The 120 residents want Hokuriku Electric Power Company to keep its Shika Town plant in Ishikawa Prefecture offline. The plaintiffs are from Ishikawa and Toyama prefectures. Their lawsuit at the Kanazawa District Court cites multiple active faults around the plant. It says a simultaneous shift in those faults could cause an earthquake larger than predicted, like the powerful quake that hit northeastern Japan last year. The plaintiffs argue that a large quake would seriously damage the Shika plant, threatening the safety of nearby residents. The nuclear disaster last year at the Fukushima Daiichi plant resulted from the loss of power to the reactors caused by the quake and tsunami. The plaintiffs argue that the disaster occurred at Fukushima even though the plant was considered safe under government guidelines on quake resistance at nuclear plants. The plaintiffs say these guidelines have lost credibility, so the Shika plant can no longer be considered safe. In 2006, the Kanazawa District Court accepted similar demands from residents around the Shika plant and ordered the utility to halt its number 2 reactor. But that ruling was overturned by the Nagoya High Court and the Supreme Court.
A Chinese bank has become the first to open a branch in Taiwan. The opening is seen as a symbol of deepening economic ties across the Taiwan Strait. The business of the Bank of China branch is so far limited to corporate financial services for Taiwanese and Chinese firms doing business in Taiwan. But the opening is expected to spur Chinese investment there. On Wednesday, about 250 people attended an opening ceremony at the major Chinese lender's Taipei branch. The move is seen as a key step toward direct trading of the Chinese and Taiwanese currencies, which are currently traded using the US dollar. Direct trading would help lower exchange risks and fees. China started direct exchange of the yuan and the Japanese yen on June 1st. The move in Taiwan is seen as another step toward the Chinese currency's globalization.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan, heard from 10 p.m. to 10:30 at 6110 or on the web at www.nhk.or.jp. All the times I've announced are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people to listen to international broadcast using a shortwave radio at home. However, if you use the internet, listening globally is also quite easy. See the links at this program's website. Every Friday morning, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's www.outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find internet links for international broadcasters, make a safe donation through PayPal, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report is free to rebroadcast upon notification. The Shortwave Report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.